missed, and look forward to resuming. I appreciate certainly all those who've pitched in and helped out in my absence, and we are continuing our study in the auditorium class, The Miracles of Jesus, and we're going to be looking at the feeding of the 5,000 and the 4,000. We covered the feeding of the 5,000 when we started this series of lessons. We looked at the various miracles in John, and so in John chapter 6 is John's account of the feeding of the 5,000. And this will give us an opportunity to kind of compare. We didn't have a chance really then at that time to go to the other accounts in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It is the only miracle of Jesus that's recorded in all four Gospels. And so we've already looked at the one Gospel of John. And John makes a very typical kind of use of the miracle or the sign, as we see some of the other kinds of signs that Jesus does in the Gospel of John. Chapter 9, Jesus heals a blind man, and at the end of that chapter, people ask Jesus, "Are we blind also?" And he says, "Well, if you were blind or saw yourself as blind, then you really would see, but because you think you see, you remain blind." And that was in response to a statement that Jesus made, that he came for the very purpose that those who see may become blind, and those that are blind may see. And again, you have to be blind not to understand the point of John chapter 9. He's not really talking about or concerned with physical blindness as much as he is about spiritual blindness. And in chapter 11, we have a dead man who's raised physically, and Jesus pronounces himself to be the resurrection and the life. And Martha says, "Well, I know in the last day my brother is going to be resurrected." And Jesus says, in essence, "That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about life that you will have even if you die. It is spiritual life, spiritual resurrection, the forgiveness of sins, which is what kills us before God." And likewise, in John chapter 6, we have Jesus feeding some people with physical bread and goes on to preach that great sermon in the synagogue in Capernaum that "I am the bread of life." And you just cannot miss that connection. And so that's the use that John makes of that. We're not really going to have occasion to look thoroughly at the use that Luke and Mark and Matthew each make of this, but Matthew and Mark are similar enough that we can probably kind of group them together a little bit. And we'll use Mark as a starting place. If you want to look in Mark chapter 6, this is where Mark's account is given. And it starts in verse 30, and we're not really going to have time to read all of these texts, unfortunately. But anytime you're studying a text, one of the things you want to do is look at what comes before it and what comes after it, right? And so what is the story that occurs immediately before this feeding of 5,000 people? Okay, John the Baptist gets himself beheaded, right? And what was the circumstances of that? Was it at an amusement park? Was it at the temple? Was it at a laundry washing ceremony? Or
where was he executed?
No, where the setting of the story, the previous.
Orgy.
Do what now?
Orgy.
Orgy. We'll say banquet. This is a PG-rated church here. Those parties would get kind of wild sometimes, and people could even die. So here you have a banquet that is put on by a human king, and of course it's all about position and power and prestige and the abuse of power and the use of power to promote self, that type of thing. And that's contrasted immediately following with a different kind of banquet that Jesus is going to give. And the focus of Jesus' banquet is not on self-promotion in the same sense that Herod does, but it's about the king, Jesus, who serves his subjects. He is concerned with the needs of the people. He has compassion on them. And so it's quite a different type of banquet. It's not in a great banquet hall. It's out in the open. It's in a desolate place, that type of thing. There's also an interesting connection here. There are a couple little features that are noteworthy. One of the unique details that Mark includes in his account of the feeding of the 5,000 is notice in verse 39, Jesus commanded them all to recline by groups on the green grass. So why does he mention there's green grass here that they set on? It may be just comfortable, and not just barren rock or something like that. But keep that in mind. And then back up a little bit to verse 34. When they come ashore, the idea here is that, the disciples go away in a boat with Jesus, and the people kind of anticipate where Jesus is going, and they run ahead, and they're on the shore waiting for Jesus when he puts in. And he saw a great multitude and felt compassion for them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. Okay. Well, where in the Bible do you know of this imagery of a sheep and a shepherd and green grass? Okay, Psalm 23, and the whole imagery of God providing for his people, like a shepherd provides for the sheep, that kind of thing, that probably is an intended echo of all of that, and not just Psalm 23, but, there's a great deal said about sheep and shepherds, and the idea of God being a shepherd of his people and that type of thing, and just like with Psalm 23, I think we tend probably to miss the point of a lot of that imagery. Because when we think of sheep shepherding sheep, I'll say that five times. The image I think most people think of is some kind of pastoral, idyllic, peaceful, warm, fuzzy kind of thing, right? But the imagery of the shepherd throughout the Old Testament is of the king, the leader, even a military leader. And you even see that in Numbers chapter 27, where Moses is pleading with God that he's going to need a successor. There's going to have to be somebody who will go in and out, who will lead God's people, the flock of God's people in and out, so they're not like sheep without a shepherd. And what he's talking about is someone who is a strong military deliverer who is able to protect the people of God and fight their battles for them and that type of thing. And you see that again in several places throughout the Old Testament. I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. You cut off the head, and you conquer the body is the idea. And so I think some of that is here as well, because the region in which this banquet happens is kind of the desolate areas of Galilee. And one of the things that the desolate areas of Galilee was known for were these revolutionary types. And the Bible even refers to some of these, like Judas the Galilean, who raised a horde of followers in the, wastelands or deserted areas of Galilee. And their intent, of course, was to overthrow the Roman Empire and get Jewish independence and that kind of thing. And we know that there's some of that going on here. Because what does John tell us in John chapter 6 and verse 15? What was the result of the feeding of the 5,000 that John records there? Okay, they wanted to take Jesus by force and make him a king. And they're not talking about the messianic king of the Old Testament as we understand it. They're talking about some kind of military leader who's going to lead them in battle and fight the Romans and deliver them and that kind of thing. And that's probably a lot of the undercurrent of what's going on here as well. And if I were to guess, because the text doesn't come out and say this, but notice what happens at the end of the story. Verse 45, immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side of Bethsaida, while he himself was sending the multitude away. And after bidding them farewell, he departed to the mountain to pray. And so the disciples are in a boat by themselves, and that's going to set up another story, of course, of the disciples kind of struggling and trying to go their own way, right? and they're not going to get very far without Jesus. But why is it that in verse 45 you get this great urgency, just like, you know, post haste, you know, get out of here. You know, Jesus is trying to get rid of the disciples and get them out of there. Well, the disciples are probably not immune to this kind of messianic fervor, and they could easily get ideas and be influenced by the kind of populist uprising of the people, and they're clearly getting in their head to take Jesus and make him king, and the last thing Jesus needs is his disciples kind of biting on that and running with it too. We know that they were susceptible like this. There's another occasion where Jesus, you know, castigates the Pharisees, and the disciples come and say, "Don't you know the Pharisees were offended by what you said?" You know, well, that they weren't just concerned about the Pharisees' feelings. It was that, you know, they were partial somewhat to the Pharisees and who they were and what they stood for. You know, and so you could envision the disciples being again somewhat. We know their understanding of the kingdom is not, you know, clear. And so it may be that Jesus is interested in getting rid of them, removing them from the scene as soon as possible because of that. Now, again, I couldn't prove that, but I think that's part of the undercurrent of the story of what's going on here. Matthew's account has the same kind of pattern here, where you have the story of Herod's banquet, and you have the contrast now with the banquet of Jesus and what it represents. There's also similarities in that in both cases, it's going to be followed up by a sequel, the feeding of the 4,000. In Mark, it's going to occur in chapter 8. We'll turn over there in a moment. In Matthew, it's in the feeding of the 5,000 in chapter 14, and then the feeding of the 4,000 is in chapter 15. And of course, there's a lot of similarity between the two. The numbers are not exactly the same. You've got 5,000 men plus women and children versus a total of about 4,000 people. You have, you know, different basket sizes and quantities and different loaves you start with. But those details are not as significant as the fact that Jesus performs a miracle and multiplies the loaves and provides for the people. Charlie? Right.
And it seems as soon as they make the collection, Jesus sends the apostles away and then sends the people away.
Right, right. So, what's the point of the miracle?
I mean, besides to show his power to feed people, usually it's a miracle with a lesson.
Okay.
I mean, it seems kind of hard to see the lesson because it's, oh no, we'll feed them. Okay, now that your friends leave.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right.
One of the accounts, when you're reading through it, Jesus has compassion on them because of the lateness of the hour. They hadn't eaten in several hours, and he was concerned about their physical safety, that they wouldn't faint on the way. So, you know, I don't know if there's a spiritual story to it, other than Jesus having compassion on the crowd.
Okay. All right. Okay, all right.
Mark really likes to throw in immediately.
He does. He does have a fondness for that word. Keeps the action kind of going along pretty quick pace. Well, I do think the story has a practical application in terms of Jesus has compassion. The miracle is going to serve a practical effect of actually feeding people that are hungry. And I think we do need to keep in mind that sickness in the ancient world was not, I've got a headache. It was real sickness. And hunger is not, you know, I missed, you know, my snack at, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's real, you know, hunger. And so, you know, it's a more serious problem than, you know, we might think it is. Greg?
Tells them to
Okay.
I think there's an imagery there.
Okay. Then? Yeah, sure.
I had always wondered why in John, where he tells him, you know, pick up all the food that nothing be lost, but later in John 6, it's when he says, the will of my Father is that I lose nothing of what he has given me.
Right.
So I see a great parallel. And how the food is distributed between spiritual food and physical food here.
Right. And I, of course, I do think there is a spiritual lesson here. You know, Jesus, in his providence, could have seen the needs of the people without having to work a miracle. It is a teaching opportunity that he's going to take advantage of, and all of the miracles are teaching lessons. They are signs pointing to something more than just itself. That it's not just about, I can feed lots of people. There's something more to it than that. Now, I do think it's going to feed this kind of messianic fervor. I mean, on the face of it, there doesn't seem to be a logical connection between, okay, here's a guy who can provide lots of food, let's make him king. But if you think in terms of what a king is supposed to do, well, providing for your people. See, we don't think of that too keenly because... even if there's a drought in one part of the country, we don't really suffer that much. We just ship food in from somewhere else, and we've insulated ourselves against the effects of deprivation and suffering. But in the ancient world, the need for providing for people and the role of the government and seeing to it that people had what they needed. And then, of course, when you consider particularly the military aspect of it, if... you're wanting your king to raise an army and go fight the Romans. Well, one advantage you're going to have is you've got a, you know, army marches on its stomach, as we say. Well, here's a guy who could, you know, you don't need a line of supply. You've got a, you know, a guy who's just going to magically produce what you need, you know, out of thin air for everybody.
Are you going to look at Mark chapter 8 tonight?
Yeah, we're going to try to get over there here in a minute. So, okay, all right. Yeah, there's a lot to cover, unfortunately. So hopefully we'll at least get the big picture here, what's going on. I do think we have a clue in John chapter 6 about, you know, what is made more explicit there, that Jesus is the bread of life. The true sustenance, true provision is made by God. It's God that we really need. We need to be nourished on God, and we will only spiritually live and be healthy by feeding on God. And I think certainly you can see that as part of the imagery of Matthew and Mark as well. But also, there is this element here, I think probably is made more explicit than it is in John. It's also in John, but it's made more explicit here, of the testing and preparation of the disciples. This is particularly clear in Matthew's account. We've talked before of the alternating story sections and speech sections and how they work together. And all of the stories in Matthew chapter 14 through 17 are in some way focusing on the disciples and preparing them for the fact Jesus is going to die, his work is going to be left to them to carry on as the apostles. And the majority of the stories that happen in this section are private incidents that happen with Jesus alone with the disciples. You know, nobody else is around. No one else is to benefit from the experience and the teaching and so on. And then the few occasions where there is a public, like the 5,000 and the 4,000, we will see that the point isn't what did the crowds learn from this, it is what did the disciples learn from this. And you see that even here in chapter 6 of Mark, even after you think the story is already finished of the feeding of the 5,000, and we've moved on to another miracle of Jesus walking on the water and bringing peace and alleviating the fear of the disciples and all of that. Verse 51, he got into the boat with them, the wind stopped, and they were greatly astonished, for they had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves, but their heart was hardened. And so clearly, Mark is having us understand the reason they failed in this event on the boat on the Sea of Galilee is because they did not understand what happened at the feeding of the 5,000. Well, what were they supposed to have learned? That Jesus can multiply bread in great quantity? Well, how would that have helped them in the boat? You know, you throw the bread on the water and maybe you can float on top of it. I mean, what's the connection here, you know? Well, the real lesson to be learned from the feeding of the 5,000 is, again, you go back to the beginning when the problem presents itself. The disciples say, send these people away. And Jesus says, no, you give them food to eat. And they're like, well, if we had 200 days pay, 6 months amount of money, we couldn't buy enough food to give everybody just a little bit. So how in the world, and if we even we had the money, are there enough bakeries open at this time of night, you know, to, that their shelves are full enough we could feed these people? And so clearly, and of course, John makes this point clear that he asks Philip particularly, what are we going to do about this? And he does it because he's intentionally going to test the disciples. And you see that here as well in Matthew and in Mark's account. And so he intends to test them. And so I think that is what really colors the story more than anything else. It is a test of the disciples. And what they need to learn is, of course, to depend upon God, depend upon Jesus, and not on themselves. It is a story of self-sufficiency versus true sufficiency, because self-sufficiency is not sufficient, right? And that's the same thing in the boat. They're trying to get along in the boat on the sea on their own power, on their own terms, as they understand things. And as they rely upon their own selves, they will fail. But Jesus will succeed. And so they have failed to understand true dependence upon God, and true sufficiency is found in God. And we're going to find the same kind of commentary on the failure of the disciples to learn in later on here in Mark and Matthew, both as well. So we'll come back and take note of that here in a moment. Thing I might ought to foreshadow here. Well, let's go ahead and turn over to Mark chapter 8. And there's a lot of similarity, as we have said, in how this unfolds. He has compassion for the multitude because they've been with him for 3 days. They have nothing to eat. If I send them away hungry, they'll faint. Some of them come from a distance. The disciples ask the same basic question, where will anyone be able to find enough to satisfy these men with bread here in a desolate place? And again, Jesus says, how many loaves do you have? And here they say 7, whereas we had 5 in the earlier account. Now, what's interesting about this, in both cases, you know, the disciples are like, you know, Jesus tells them, you give them something, right? You give them bread. And they say, we can't do it. Now, the irony of that statement is, what are the disciples going to wind up doing? Giving them bread. They're going to do exactly what Jesus told them to do to begin with. And this is really fascinating to me because we're given commands by God all of the time, and we set out to try to do them by our own ingenuity and our own strength, and we fail. But God can empower us to do them if we'll do it His way. And that's kind of what you have here. They say it's an impossibility. Oh, we can't do that. You've set the bar too high. But no, He'll see to it that they do give these people bread, but it's going to be through Him and relying on Him and through the power that He provides. And the other interesting lesson in both of these accounts is Jesus doesn't focus on what they don't have. He focuses on what they do have. See, that's what the disciples are thinking. They're thinking of all we don't have. We don't have the money. We don't have the bread. We don't have enough. That's our problem so often. You know, God tells us to do something. Well, I can't because of this or that, or, you know, we've got one excuse or the other. God tells Moses, go down to Pharaoh and tell him to let my people go. Well, I can't do that because of this, that, and the other. Well, the disciples are no different in that regard. But Jesus focuses the attention on what do you have. And they have these five loaves. They have these seven loaves. And that's what God's going to work with in order to multiply this great quantity of food. And so here on this occasion, 4,000 are fed. Now, what's interesting about this is this miracle appears to take place in the region of the Decapolis, which is a Gentile territory. So the text doesn't come out and explicitly say this, but the implication would be that these are Gentiles, whereas the previous group we would assume to be Jews, and that would add another layer to this, that God's grace and his bestowal of provision is for both Jew and Gentile, and be a way of underscoring that kind of inclusive character of the work of Christ. Now, we're in chapter 8. Lucas, there is a point you wanted to make.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, when you get down to verse 14, when they were going somewhere and they forgot to take bread, and Jesus says, beware the leaven of the Pharisees and of Herod, and they reasoned together in verse 16 and said, it's because we have no bread. He says, did you not learn the lesson of the 4,000 and the 5,000? And basically, I was going to say what you've already said. They should have learned that when they're with Jesus, they're okay. Mm. Regardless of the situation, if they learn to rely on Jesus, they're going to be okay. And instead of relying on themselves.
Right. And I do think this will, in Matthew's account, it's in Matthew 16, so it's kind of easy to remember. Chapter 14, feeding the 5,000. Chapter 15, feeding the 4,000. Chapter 16, kind of what's the point of it all? And in Mark, it's back in chapter 6 and then here in chapter 8. And the commentary here follows pretty closely on the heels of the feeding of the 4,000, as we've seen here. And we'll come back to this in a moment. One other interesting similarity I wanted to note between the feeding of the 5,000 and 4,000 is the way that it happens. Both stories tell us that Jesus took the bread, he blessed it, he broke it, and he gave it. And there's one other place in the Bible that says that. And where is that? At the institution of the Lord's Supper. That's not an accident, I don't think. And I think we are to understand that the same imagery that is being taught in the miraculous feeding accounts is going to be repeated with the Lord's Supper, but that itself is also foreshadowing another banquet, which is going to be that eternal banquet of heaven, that it's portrayed as a great wedding feast where God will provide in superabundance for eternity for every need that we have. There is no hunger, there is no suffering, there is no death, and so on. And so it's a marvelous image, a powerful image. And so Jesus wants to convey that message to us. When we say all sufficient, God is all sufficient. Every need is provided for. That's what you need to learn from this. Now, on this occasion, some people were fed some physical food, which presumably temporarily got them along for a while till they got hungry again and needed to eat again. I don't think we're to understand these thousands of people never ate again because, you know, they ate and they were filled and, you know, the food never digested or whatever, you know. No, they were just normal again, like Lazarus died again, you know, that type of thing. But it is a sign pointing to the fact that God, you know, of course, God was compassionate about these physically hungry people, but Jesus didn't come and feed all the physically hungry people in the world. But he did come to feed all the people that were spiritually hungry, those who were starving and thirsting for righteousness and salvation. And that is found in Christ. And that's the same lesson and principle that we think about in connection with the Lord's Supper as we partake of it each week, that Christ is the true source of life. And by not just eating some magical bread and drinking some magical grape juice, but by eating Christ and drinking Christ, by taking Christ into ourselves and being what we eat, becoming like Christ, that His blood flows in our veins and it is His life that lives within us. That is where we find the all-sufficient life and the provision that God has made for us. And that eternity is simply going to be the absolute perfection of that. And we will no longer have the struggles of the limitations of this flesh and struggling with the problem of sin and selfishness and those kinds of issues. Part of the provision of God, I mean, you think about it, all sin that we have is a hunger for something. You know, we're looking for something. And ultimately what we're looking for is God. We're looking for true happiness. We're looking for true fulfillment and satisfaction. But we just don't know where to find it. And so for one reason or another, we think sex or drugs or fame or power or success of one kind or another is what's going to fill that hunger and provide for us, but leaves us empty. And so what will truly fill that hole and that feed that hunger? And nothing but God will do that. And when we will know God perfectly throughout eternity, we will know no need. And that takes us back to Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. I won't lack a thing. I won't need anything. Because everything is fully and completely supplied by God. So it's a fascinating, you know, kind of lesson once you get into it and see the power of the sign or the imagery that I think is being used here. Shane?
Just a modern-day application that I've taken from these accounts, especially the account that we find in John chapter 6, you know, the after story that we don't see in the other than Matthew or Mark, but when the people follow him, they're looking, where'd he go? Realize that, you know, Jesus has gone to the other side of the water, and so they all go and they find him. But Jesus, how'd you get here? And he tells them, you didn't seek me because you saw signs. I mean, they didn't care about the miracles. He said, all you're seeking for is because you ate your fill and you filled your belly. And I've had discussions with people that are denominations, and they use food, and they're gonna people come and have a free lunch, and we'll preach the gospel. And I had a discussion with a preacher about how do you know that you're feeding their soul and not just their belly? And well, you know, you hope that they're taking some of it in. So would you consider yourself a better preacher than Jesus? Because Jesus had 5,000 people that he preached to, and the bulk of them, all they were concerned about was filling the belly again. That's just something that I take from this story. It's probably not what Jesus intended, but it is certainly an example of
right.
Feeding people doesn't make them interested.
Right. Well, and the thing we ultimately have to learn is that a self-centered promotion of the gospel is self-defeating because it's contradicting the gospel. Because the message of the gospel is the problem is you, and you need to die to self. And it is no longer you that live, but Christ that lives in you. You need to deny self, take up the cross, and be crucified with Christ, and then you'll be able to live a true life, raised by Christ, to walk in His image, And so if we're sharing the gospel with people, and it's all predicated on, look what this is going to do for you, It's all about you and your self-interest and filling your belly or meeting some other kind of need like that. That's completely contrary to the whole nature of the gospel. We're focusing on you and building up self and promoting self and inflating this selfishness and reinforcing it, all the while trying to tell them it's not about self. It's about denying self. Have another piece of pizza. It's all about denying self. It's ludicrous. It's as absurd as the Corinthians coming together. Oh, we're going to take the Lord's Supper. We're going to commemorate the crucified Christ, who is all about selflessness and sacrifice and serving, and all the while they're fighting and bickering and, trying to one-up each other and so on. Completely contradictory to that very thing. So Again, I do think, as Shane said, a very powerful lesson there. Very quickly, let's look in Matthew 16. This is Matthew's account, parallel to Mark chapter 8. Matthew chapter 16, verse 5, the disciples came to the other side and forgotten to take bread. Jesus said to them, "Watch out and beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees." And they began to discuss among themselves, saying, "It's because we took no bread. Jesus is getting on to us because we didn't bring any bread along." Jesus, aware of this, said, "You men of little faith, why do you discuss among yourselves that you have no bread? Do you not yet understand or remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up, or the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many large baskets you took up? How is it you do not understand that I did not speak to you concerning bread," literal bread? "Beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." And then they understood that he did not say to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And so, again, as we noted before, that their mind immediately turns to physical things. That's where their mind was running before. They think of the kingdom in physical terms. They think of Jesus in physical terms. They think of providing for these people in physical terms. And as long as they keep thinking that way, they're not understanding God and what the purpose and mission of Christ is. And that's why he's getting on to them here, you know. And I mentioned before that, you know, I remember when I was growing up being taught that you always take things literally if you can. Well, there's no reason you couldn't take Jesus' statement literally. Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees. Okay. Yeah, bad yeast, you know, let's watch out. Why was that the wrong way to take what Jesus said? Because they should have known Jesus isn't about bread. He's not preoccupied with bread. He's not always, you know, looking for the next great baking recipe. You know, he is about his Father's business. He's about spiritual things. And so when he says, "Watch out for the leaven of the Pharisees," my first hunch is he's probably not talking about literal yeast. You know, he's talking about something else. And to their credit on this occasion, by simply rebuking them and repeating what he said, they figured it out, you know, to their credit. He didn't have to spell it out for them. They did conclude Jesus was warning them about the teaching of the Pharisees. Well, again, that illustrates to us the focus is really on what did the disciples learn from the previous two miracles, and they had really failed the test, unfortunately, and you know, are we any better than they are, you know, sometimes? And I think what it illustrates is you can sit in Bible class and you can fill in a workbook and tell people how many people and how many loaves and how many this and that and still not understand a bit of what you're reading. And there's a great danger in that. So the Bible isn't just about filling in a workbook and what are the facts. It's about reading with understanding and understanding who Jesus is and what it's really all about. Well, we'll have to stop there for today. We'll look at the Syrophoenician woman next week. And so that accounts in Matthew and in Mark, so you've been looking at